This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our own Michael Ratner hosts a special in-depth look at Guantanamo Bay Prison. What it is, why prisoners are still there, and under what conditions they're living.
We're bringing you this one-hour special because it's the fifth anniversary of what many have referred to as the United States Gulag in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
We'll hear a description of the camp from the first lawyer who visited there. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Coming up on the fifth anniversary of the imprisonment of hundreds of Muslims at Guantanamo, January 11th is the day that the first people were taken from around the world to what can only be described as an interrogation torture center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. There's going to be a lot of activities on January 11th, some of which we'll describe. We're going to be in Washington on the steps of the Supreme Court. There's activities all over the world in protesting against this prison camp and what this prison torture camp stands for in the world. We're going to bring you some perspective on the camp, how the U.S. got a hold of a piece of land in Cuba, what's happened in the past, what's happening right now, and what's going forward. We'll be looking back at some of our segments where we've covered specific issues going from torture to indefinite detention to access to attorneys. I'd like to begin, really, with giving our listeners some sense of how the U.S. got to Guantanamo. Guantanamo is a 45-square-mile base. It includes a very good harbor, which is one of the reasons the U.S. wanted to get a hold of it. It's in the southeastern portion of Cuba. I've actually been there. I've been on both sides. I've been to the Guantanamo City, which is still and remains Cuban. And I've also been to Guantanamo itself when I was representing with the Center for Constitutional Rights, the Haitian refugees. Anyway, the U.S. got a hold of this 45 square miles by intervening in what was the Spanish, we call the Spanish-American War, but it was really in the beginning the Spanish-Cuban War. The Cubans were trying to, in the late 1800s, get rid of the yoke of Spanish colonialism, and they went to war. And the U.S., which had always had its eye on Cuba and didn't like the fact that the Spanish owned it, decided, supposedly, to intervene on behalf of the Cubans and help defeat the Spanish. And of course, that's what they did. And after they did that, they decided to stay a little longer than they initially had said they would, finally giving Cuba its, quote, independence. And I say, quote, independence, because it was with all kinds of strings attached in the Cuban Constitution about U.S. intervention. One of the provisions of the new Constitution and the laws that were passed by the new Cuban government was to give the United States a perpetual, forever lease on 45 square miles of Cuba called Guantanamo Bay. And it's a lease that goes forever. It's $4,000 a year paid in gold, supposedly. The Cuban revolutionary government refuses to take the money. I think it comes by check now. So the U.S. really runs this 45 square miles. The language of the lease is that the U.S. has complete jurisdiction and control. That's important. It's complete jurisdiction and control. That means that the Cuban government has nothing to say about what goes on that military base. And the U.S. can do whatever it wants on that base. And part of what the U.S. says is that there's no law that applies there, that the U.S. law doesn't apply, and therefore the U.S. has a free hand, and that U.S. courts can't do anything about what goes on at Guantanamo. That's been their consistent position for many years. Another key provision of the lease is that the lease says it's to be used only as a coaling station. Now, that may sound a little bit archaic, but in the 1880s, 1890s, early 1900s, ships didn't run on oil in that at that period, and they needed coaling stations all over the world to stop and refill on coal. And the U.S. wanted this base, apart from a lot of other reasons, they wanted this so that U.S. ships could stop there. That brings to mind a question, well, what if the base is not being used for the purpose of the lease? What if it's used, as it's used today, as a prison for Guantanamo detainees? Isn't that a violation of the lease? The answer is yes, it is. And the next question, shouldn't that mean the end of the lease? The answer is yes, it should. But of course, Cuba, being the much weaker country here, is in no position to invade the base with its forces and take it back. So the U.S. not only took this base illegally, completely illegally, by an invasion and then a requirement that the terms of its leaving Cuba would be it gets 45 square miles of sovereign territory of Cuba, but it then went ahead even after this lease was signed and is in effect since the early 1900s to violate the lease and use it for purposes not prohibited by the lease. So what this really represents to the U.S., a little spot of America in the Caribbean. And when I say that, you'll get the sense, if you don't go to visit Guantanamo Prison, we have here a little American city. It has 8,500 people, U.S. soldiers, naval people, Air Force, others, and their dependents. It has a McDonald's, it has movie theaters, it has soccer fields, it has schools, high schools, it even has a way you can go to college at this base. And when you go down there, you do get the sense that this is a little piece of suburban America, tract housing, the usual. That's until you cross, of course, to the side where the U.S. kept for many years the current set of Guantanamo detainees and in the past kept the Haitian detainees. My first real experience with Guantanamo was during the Haitian refugee crisis. As I said, I'd been to Guantanamo earlier when I'd been to Cuba, not to the base, but to the Cuban side. It's a wonderful part of Cuba, it's southern Cuba, very, very beautiful in many respects. That's until you go into the military base. The first real use of this base that was made in modern times that is utterly contrary to the lease and utterly contrary to any kind of standard of human rights was what we call the Haitian refugee crisis. In the early 90s, President Aristide was overthrown as the legitimate president of Haiti. It caused thousands of refugees to flee Haiti. They were in the high seas in the Caribbean, trying to escape anywhere where they could save their lives. The U.S. didn't want those refugees coming into the United States, and after a couple of weeks started picking them up and taking thousands and thousands of refugees to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and to the U.S. military base, where they were forced to live in horrible conditions. Tents were set up on runways, and at one point there were as many as 25,000 refugees. As a year or so passed, many of those were sent back to Haiti to, unfortunately, to their killers and torturers. A few were given asylum in the United States, and then there was a special segment of them. That special segment is what I would call the first HIV refugee camp ever created in the world. And they did so, according to the U.S., because the U.S. had a bar on letting people who were HIV positive into the United States, even though the U.S. admitted that these 400 or 500 people at Guantanamo, which is an HIV person and their family or their children or their wife or their husband, even though the U.S. admitted that they actually had legitimate asylum claims, that if they were sent back to Haiti, they would be subject to persecution from the government that had overthrown President Aristide. So they set up this barbed wire camp in this section of Cuba, which the U.S. claims ownership of, Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. As part of a team of lawyers, I, along with a man named Harold Koh, who's currently the dean at Yale Law School, and a clinic at Yale, brought a series of litigations to try and close down that camp. It took 3 years for us to do it. From a personal point of view, it was an experience that has basically seared my memory and my emotions. It was probably the hardest thing I've ever done, not legally, not going into court, but going to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and seeing these 400 or 500 refugees behind barbed wire with their children in conditions that really were, that you wouldn't want to put animals into living. Unfortunately, although we won the Guantanamo Haitian cases in the end, the United States government got used to the idea of using Guantanamo as a prison and used to the idea that they didn't have to give people any rights there. Even though we won some rights for the Haitians, we didn't actually win those in the Supreme Court. I want to bring you some of the story of that through the eyes of someone who wrote an important book on the struggle to free the Haitians that really talks about Guantanamo. The book is called Storming the Court. We're now going to go to a segment that we aired previously. We interviewed Brant Goldstein, the author of a book called Storming the Court, which is the story of the three-year struggle that Harold Coe at Yale, myself at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and the law students engaged in to try and close down and successfully close down this HIV camp at Guantanamo. And the excerpt will give you some sense of the struggle that we were involved in, as well as the U.S. position that this Guantanamo is a law-free zone.
I focus on just a few of the law students and Harold Coe, the law professor, and this extraordinary refugee, Yvonne Pascal, who spent 5 years telling me her story. She, in particular, is, I tell this story, the Haitian experience, through her eyes. My goal is to get the reader to empathize with someone who we might consider, as Harold Coe described it before going to the Supreme Court, the ultimate other in this country, somebody who is poor, from a developing country, who is black, who speaks Creole, and is not the kind of person that the INS, bluntly speaking, has been very kind to. And the amazing thing is she is now in this country thanks to these students. She works a full-time job, pays for her own health care, is a homeowner, and her older son is serving in the United States Marines and just came back from Iraq. And whether or not you agree with the war there, which I, for one, do not, if that's not a contribution to this country, I don't know
what
is.
The ultimate contribution.
Well, let's
really
hope he's organizing anti-war GIs over there. Brant, let me ask you this. This would seem to have set a precedent with respect to stashing people in a hole in Guantanamo, but in fact, that's what they're doing now. So what happened, and why hasn't this been able to use as a precedent to get those innocent people who are languishing in Guantanamo as we speak out of there?
That's a great question. And the point is this. The Clinton administration agreed to comply with the order to release Yvonne Pascal and the other 300 innocent men, women, and children. But the Clinton administration was not comfortable with the precedent that the Constitution applies on Guantanamo. And so the Justice Department forced the Yale team representing the Haitians to make a deal. The Justice Department agreed they would not appeal the case. They would release the Haitians. But the Yale team had to agree that the lower court decision would be vacated, which is a fancy word for meaning erased, removed from the books. So what happens is, and for people who are not lawyers, this can be done as long as the case has not been finally decided by the Supreme Court. The decision, so to speak, belongs to the parties and not the public until the case is over. So as part of the settlement, it was wiped off the books.
So this is Clinton's Justice Department that did
Clinton's
that?
It was Clinton's Justice Department that did this. And here's the great irony then. You flash forward 8 years later, the Bush administration lawyers who drafted the memo that said habeas corpus will not be available on Guantanamo from our reading of the past cases based their conclusion in part on reading the Haitian case and saying the Clinton Justice Department had it vacated. We don't have anything to worry about.
So what's the moral here?
When you fight for a precedent like this, and Harold Coe will tell you, they were very concerned about giving it up. But their first and foremost obligation was to the 300 innocent men, women, and children that they were trying to save. And they realized, we've got to get them out of there. We have to bring them to this country and worry about them first. And if the cost of this is that the precedent goes, perhaps that's what's going to happen. And there's another wrinkle here.
Yeah, and you know what I think also, you fight and you win a case in the courts, it's like a shell game, you know. Then the legislature takes it away from you, or the executive takes it away from you, and we really don't have any body that represents us. And so these things happen to us continually.
Just because you win wrinkle? One battle doesn't mean that you've won the war,
exactly.
Unfortunately.
What's the other wrinkle?
The other wrinkle here is that, of course, one could say, well, they could have fought on appeal. They felt that they would lose the case if it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the reason they felt this was that the Supreme Court had intervened early on in the case in favor of the government. The students had won, right out of the box, a decision that they should have access to Guantanamo to meet with their clients, which is, of course, a big issue today. And after having met with them briefly, the Supreme Court stepped in and issued what's called a stay, meaning freezing all proceedings and not allowing the students further access.
Grant Goldstein, author of Storming the Court, the story of our struggle to free the Haitian refugees from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Some people have asked me, well, how did we get where we are today with the Guantanamo detainees and representing them? I remember after 9/11 that a lot of things happened, obviously, in terms of civil liberties. The idea that the president could pick up people anywhere in the world and detain them wherever he wanted. Well, by late December, it had become clear, it had become clear in the newspapers, December 2001, that the president planned to take people to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And we at the Center for Constitutional Rights, we knew what that meant. We knew that he put people in Guantanamo. The principle that this administration and that past administrations, whether Democrat or Republican, have wanted to run Guantanamo is that it's a law-free zone in which no court can look into what the U.S. is doing in Guantanamo and no law applies. In other words, the U.S. can do what it wants to human beings. So we at the Center for Constitutional Rights decided in December that we would represent the first people taken to Guantanamo. And we gathered together a few other lawyers who we hoped would help with us. We couldn't get any other human rights organizations to go with us, but we did get some other lawyers who were death penalty lawyers, among them Joe Margulis, a death penalty lawyer from Minneapolis, Clyde Stafford Smith, who ran a Louisiana death penalty project, and eventually a man named Tom Wilner, who represented Kuwaitis. On January 9th or 10th, I read in the newspaper the name David Hicks, and it listed David Hicks's attorney. Now, the names were not supposed to come out of who was going to be at Guantanamo, but because David Hicks was Australian, they'd notified, the U.S. government had notified the Australian embassy. The embassy had notified Hicks's family in Australia. Hicks's family had hired this lawyer named Steve Kenny. I found Kenny's number. I got on the phone with Steve Kenny, and after a couple of days of discussing it, Steve Kenny said, we at the Center for Constitutional Rights were free to file, and he wanted us to file, a writ of habeas corpus on behalf of David Hicks. That means we could go into federal district court and say to the government, that's what a writ of habeas corpus is, why are you holding me? What is your legal justification? I just want to go forward quickly. We're 5 years later now, and you should understand we are still in court, and we have never yet had a hearing on whether or not David Hicks or our other clients, 500 or now 400 or so, whether any of them should still be in Guantanamo. We've never had that hearing. This is after 5 years of litigation. In any case, we filed this case with only a handful of attorneys. The hate mail we got was hundreds of hate mails. Things like, Michael, you should go to Guantanamo and let them eat you, or invite them to your house and let them eat your children, or, you know, what kind of business is this? Terrorists don't deserve constitutional rights. Rumsfeld said these were the worst of the worst. For all we knew at the center when we took these cases, we were representing, you know, people who may have been involved in 9/11. We didn't know. We thought that the writ of habeas corpus, which really stems out of the Magna Carta in 1215, was so fundamental that every human being deserved to have the right to file that writ. That's what differentiated any country from a police state, any so-called democracy, that we felt we had to file on behalf of David Hicks. We filed on behalf of David Hicks. We then eventually got more clients. We, of course, couldn't tell our clients. We couldn't visit our clients. They didn't know we filed on their behalf. We really filed on behalf of their parents or their families under what's called Next Friend. And again, to fast forward, today at the Center for Constitutional Rights, we're coordinating some 500 cases, maybe 400 now, as people have been released slowly, of Guantanamo detainees who are still there. There's just about 400. And we're coordinating a group of 500 attorneys across the country who are representing the people at Guantanamo. A huge shift and change from the four or five of us who started these cases at the Center for Constitutional Rights to the 500 lawyers across the country. So our first client at the Center for Constitutional Rights was David Hicks. We then had the Tipton clients, who were the English people who were now freed, and eventually, as I said, representing essentially everybody at Guantanamo. Some people have asked, and often we get asked, well, aren't you guys just representing a bunch of terrorists? Why should we let these people go? The U.S. should be keeping these people. They should be torturing them for information, etc. And, you know, a lot of people believe that myth. But there's, in the last 3 or 4 years, what's unfolded here is the U.S. has a set of the wrong guys. These people were picked up in Afghanistan and Pakistan and in other places around the world. And they are by no means the worst of the worst. And you ask yourself, well, how are these people picked up? 90% of them, hear that figure, 90% of them were not even picked up by the United States. They were picked up by warlords in Afghanistan or picked up by people in Pakistan, Pakistan intelligence or other military people in Pakistan. And they weren't necessarily, to put it mildly, people who had fought against the United States, people who were alleged terrorists, or people who were in Al-Qaeda. And in fact, as I said, 90% were not even picked up by the U.S. So how were they turned over to the U.S.? The majority, high majority, were turned over for money. You heard it, money. The U.S. put out a system of what you'd call rewards. It said if you turn over a Taliban person, an Al-Qaeda person, we'll give you money. And we happened to get a hold of the flyer that the U.S. dropped over Afghanistan and Pakistan to encourage warlords and others to turn over alleged Al-Qaeda people. Now, of course, if there was a dispute going on, you're having a fight with another village, what are you going to do as a warlord? You're going to turn that person over for money. And when you hear what this flyer said, you'll recognize who got to Guantanamo and while they're there. The leaflet is titled Psychological Operations, PSYOP, has a number on it, has a picture of, can't tell who the picture's of, a couple of pictures, and then in bold letters, it says, get wealth and power beyond your dreams. Think about that, everybody. Wealth and power beyond your dreams. Then it continues, help the anti-Taliban force rid Afghanistan of murderers and terrorists. And then it says at the bottom, you can receive millions of dollars for helping the anti-Taliban force catch Al-Qaeda and Taliban murderers. This is enough money to take care of your family, your village, your tribe for the rest of your life. Pay for livestock and doctors and school books and housing for all your people. Well, let me just say something. You see leaflets like that dropped on villages in Afghanistan that are as poor can be, and you're having a fight with your neighbors, or there's some guy who's causing you trouble who you don't like, or it's something else going on. What are you going to do if you're a bad guy? You're going to turn over somebody who may very well be a good guy. And that's how 90%, remember that, 90% of the people got to Guantanamo. If you want to see that flyer, and it's really something to see, you can go to our website, lawanddisorder.org. We'll have a picture of that flyer on the website. So the majority of people got there through this flyer bribe. Others have got there by being picked up around the world by the United States, either because the U.S. thought they did something or because the U.S. decided to render them, to snatch them, kidnap them out of another country. There's 5 people there that came out of Bosnia. There's people from Morocco. There's people from the Gambia, from all over the world. Again, without any trials, any hearings, nothing. The U.S. snatches these people, picks them up, and takes them to Guantanamo. One of the things they sometimes do also is on the way to Guantanamo, that may be your final stop, but they also engage in the practice, which we've discussed on this program, of a little bit of rendition on the way. So if you're picked up, for example, let's say you're picked up in Bosnia, they may not fly you right to Guantanamo. They may do a short stop, 6 weeks, 6 months, in Egypt. What happens in Egypt? You get turned over to Egyptian security, and you have the heck tortured out of you. And so there are various of our clients at Guantanamo were sent to other countries where they were tortured for a while for whatever they could say, which probably wasn't very much, and then taken to Guantanamo as the interrogation camp for the rest of their many years that they were going to spend in Guantanamo. They picked up all these different types of people, and one of the most notorious cases that we've seen is the case of the Uyghurs. The Uyghurs are an ethnic group, religious group that lives in Western China. They're Muslims. The Chinese government doesn't like them. They picked up, the U.S. picked up a number of Uyghurs who had fled China to go into Afghanistan. And during the post-Afghanistan invasion, during the sweeps, they were sold by Pakistani bounty hunters to the United States in late 2001. Some 23 Uyghurs were being held at Guantanamo. There's still a number of them there. Even the United States found that they were not enemy combatants and shouldn't be in Guantanamo. But what happened? They never told the lawyers, Sabin Willett, that they shouldn't be in Guantanamo until he finally got access to them a few years later. And they said, you know, the government doesn't think we should be here. Sabin Willett, their attorney, tried to get them out of Guantanamo. They're not enemy combatants. Even the U.S. acknowledged completely innocent. And he goes into court, and on the eve of arguing the court case in the Court of Appeals, what does the United States do? They send them a letter saying, we've decided to get at least a number of the Uyghurs, his five clients, five of his clients, out of Guantanamo. And where do they send them? They send them to Albania. Well, remarkable. I mean, it's true, Albanian's a Muslim country, but the guys didn't speak any of the language in Albania. Their families are not anywhere near them. They have no way of leaving Albania. And so that's what the U.S. did with them. Sabin flew off to see them in Albania and see what he could do for them. And we're now going to be bringing you an excerpt of an interview we did a few months ago with Sabin Willett regarding the situation of the innocent Uyghurs.
Nine men live in a hut together. It's about 20 feet by 10 feet in size. There's another hut that has a television in it, but television doesn't work except to play. I think they have a Harry Potter movie. There's no news, no newspapers, no communication with their families. Precious few telephone calls. We've been able to have some lawyer phone calls, but the government listens in. They can't have any telephone communication with their families, for example. It's a very small place. There's a yard they can walk in, which is about the size of, a volleyball court. There's a view out to sea. The government likes to talk about the beautiful view at Camp Iguana. But if you come from Central Asia, a view out to sea just reminds you of how isolated you are, how far from home. That's where they live.
What is your interaction with them like?
My interaction like? Well, we go down to visit them in Camp Iguana. And it's, it's wonderful and it's heartbreaking. I mean, it's another human face to see someone else to talk to for a few hours is a great thing for people who are so isolated. But our relative powerlessness as their lawyers is difficult. I mean, we have to keep coming back explaining that although they've been told they're innocent and although judges have heard their case, nothing is happening. If you have a secret prison on an island, and if the president gets up and says that the people down there are terrorists, then people believe it. I mean, you talk to almost any lawyer who's been to Guantanamo, and the first thing he'll tell you is, my client isn't a terrorist. He's not even alleged to be a terrorist. But if you have this secret place where you can kind of put people and you can deny access to the outside world, it becomes a vent for the public's frustration and fear. You can say, look at us. We're fighting a war on terror. We've got all these bad people. And John Q. Public thinks, well, maybe the president's protecting me from bad people. He's got them all locked up down there. And, you know, I don't want to listen to some wild-eyed leftist lawyers complaining about that. They should be locked up down there, too. I think it's all about that.
That's why we got you in the case, Sabin.
Yes, one of the more right-wing of the lawyers.
For those of you just joining us now, we're with Sabin Willett, a partner with the law firm of Bingham McCutcheon in Boston. Author of two novels, he's now representing the Uyghurs in Guantanamo.
Tell us, what got you involved in the first place?
I went to a seminar that was given by a local panel on international law in Boston, and I was, like everybody else, alarmed by what I was reading in the newspapers about Abu Ghraib. But, you know, I'm a bankruptcy lawyer. I work for banks. I don't know anything about international law and didn't know a thing about the law of war, Geneva Conventions, any of that stuff. So I went to the seminar and listened to an army captain with even shorter hair than mine start to describe how all this stuff was illegal. So it wasn't just awful and immoral. It was actually illegal, which was comforting that it was illegal. And I just decided it was time to get off the sidelines. You got to do something about this.
That was Sabin Willett, who is representing and still representing some of the Uyghurs who remain in Guantanamo.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
We go now to another excerpt from an interview Law and Disorder did regarding another Guantanamo detainee who has also become notorious. The interview is with Tosif Paracha, the nephew of Saifullah Paracha, who is in Guantanamo today. Saifullah Paracha was on a trip to Bangkok in 2003, kidnapped on the way to Bangkok by the United States. His family did not hear from him for 2 months until they finally received a letter from the Red Cross saying that he was being held in Bagram, Afghanistan, sadly another notorious interrogation torture camp. After he was detained in Bagram for over a year, he was moved to Guantanamo Bay on October 15, 2004. And that is where he remains today. Let's have a listen to that segment with Tosif Paracha.
With my uncle, he's currently, from what I understand, he's being held in the worst camp in Guantanamo, Camp 5.
Camp 5 is really bad.
Yeah, he's being
Describe
held.
Describe that. Describe what you know.
He's in total solitary confinement.
It's not that different from your cousin's situation.
It's not that different, no. But I guess in Guantanamo, you know, you hear a lot of really bad stories of how they torture people.
Well, that's right. I mean, the physical surroundings are essentially solitary or an open sort of prison where the elements can come in, where they can strip you very easily, where they can leave a light on 24 hours. The guards pass by twice a minute, so every 30 seconds you have to go to the bathroom basically in front of everybody, the whole thing. I mean,
And the thing with him is, you know, he's 58 years old. He's in very poor health. He has medical conditions. He has heart problems. He has diabetes. But the family's really concerned about his conditions. How can someone at this age who has these many medical conditions handle someplace like Guantanamo?
Now, he has lawyers now. I'm in the Center for Constitutional Rights. I know he's working with the lawyers that we've gotten.
G.T. Hunt, yeah. We have G.T. Hunt, but it's
Has Hunt has visited him, right?
Hunt's visited him twice. Hunt has told us that when he was kidnapped in Bangkok, that basically they beat him, they stripped him naked, they didn't feed him for 3 days, and then they sent him to Bagram.
In Bagram, they do pretty bad.
Bagram was really bad. See, I have an interrogation report. The ACLU sued the U.S. government on these interrogation reports. This interrogation report accidentally left his name. The redactor accidentally left his name in there. And it talks about how he was treated extremely inhumanely, how he was treated aggressively in a hostile manner. It refers to his health, how his health wasn't that good. He has shortness of breath. He was feeling very dizzy.
I mean, these guys are bad guys.
Yeah, so, you know, this proves that he was tortured. A 58-year-old man, you know, how can you treat someone like that? It's not like, you know, they say that the biggest terrorists, the worst people are in Guantanamo. You know, my uncle's 58 years old. He has several he can't harm anybody. In Pakistan, you know, he set up hospitals in the poorest areas. He set up schools. He set up orphanages. He's been known for his charity work.
And that was Tosif Paracha, the nephew of Saifullah Paracha. Saifullah is still an inmate of the Guantanamo Bay detention camp. One of the attorneys who works at the Center for Constitutional Rights is Gita Gutierrez. Gita has been representing Guantanamo detainees for the full 5 years, and she goes to the camp quite frequently. Her current clients include Mohammed El-Khatani, as well as Majid Khan, and others. She has just recently returned from Guantanamo, and I asked her for her description of what Guantanamo looks like today. This is what she had to say.
It's one thing that's striking is you don't actually see prisoners when you go down there. It's it's a very heavy lockdown. Many of the buildings are windowless. It's a large facility, and there's tons of razor wire and soldiers, and you're clearly at a military prison and not a regular prison. The cells that I've seen in the different camps are very sparse. The state of the prisoners' kind of mental health condition right now is very poor. There's not a lot for them to do. Many of them just simply sit in their cells, either on a metal bunk. Listeners have probably seen pictures of the cells that the DOD Public Affairs Office puts out. That's really all they have is a Quran and a metal bunk. They might have a pad that they can sleep on. And they often don't get out of their cells very much at all.
Now, is the camp divided into different camps, or is it all one big prison?
There are several camps, and again, this is information that's made public by the Department of Defense. There are several camps called Camp 1, 2, 3, and 4 that are all within the larger Camp Delta, and those camps vary in the, you know, quote, privileges that the prisoners have. There's also Camp Echo, which is where the attorneys meet with our clients, and those are single isolation units. They're little huts, and each hut is divided by a solid wall, and on each side of that wall is a cell for the prisoner and a table where we meet with them shackled down onto the floor. Then there are two other camps, Camp 5 and the recently built Camp 6, that are very, very restricted maximum security facilities. And despite, I think, DOD's effort to spin these as kind of new state-of-the-art facilities, I think that they're incredibly depressing places for the prisoners and extremely restrictive.
Now, how many hours a day do you get to actually visit clients when you go there?
Not very many. It's a long trek from where we sleep across Guantanamo Bay on a ferry and then across the base itself to get to the prison. So although we start early in the morning, we often only have 2 hours. Sometimes if we have difficulty getting through the security searches at the beginning, we might have an hour and a half with our client. I've had times where the wrong client's been brought out. We're then pulled out for an hour and a half during lunch and prayer and then allowed to go back in the afternoon, usually for about another two and a half hours. So in a full day, we work very hard to have at least 5 hours with our client.
That was Geeta describing her recent visit to the Guantanamo Bay detention camp. One of the revelations about Guantanamo as we went on with the litigation from 2002 was the fact that the U.S. was engaging in torture. I have to admit to a certain naivete here. I understood why they were using Guantanamo. I understood it as an interrogation camp. I understood it as a place outside the law. But I didn't think that the U.S. would actually systematically engage in torture of the people at Guantanamo. And at first really was revealed to me clients called the Tipton Three, who were three men from England. They had been released because of pressure from the English government. It was proven that they were actually working in a store in England at the time the U.S. claimed they were meeting with Osama bin Laden, and they actually had confessed to meeting with Osama bin Laden. And of course, they confessed to that because they were tortured. And they told me the stories of being held down to the floor for hours, stripped, hooded, sexual humiliation, dogs, the whole bit. And eventually, of course, that was demonstrated to be true as we saw that Rumsfeld had actually authorized these very techniques. At first, I wasn't so completely convinced. I didn't know. It just sounded, you know, too bizarre to me. But of course, as it later got revealed, this was all authorized by Rumsfeld and others, including lawyers, et cetera, at the Defense Department's, as well as within the President's office. These kinds of techniques were authorized. The Tipton Report, which became quite well known, which is a 100-page report documenting their torture, is available on the Center for Constitutional Rights website. That's ccr-ny.org. A few months ago, Law and Disorder interviewed Geeta Gutierrez to talk about El-Khatani, Mohammed El-Khatani, who is one of her clients, who was brutally tortured. And interestingly, in his case, we not only have his words about the fact that he was tortured, but the government, as they probably did in every one of these cases, but in his case we got a hold of it, or Time Magazine did, the log of his two-month torture. And that included the whole gamut, everything. Sleep deprivation, stripping, sexual humiliation, injection of liquids into his body while he was strapped to a chair and not allowed to go to the bathroom, a whole series of really, really brutal techniques of torture. And here to describe that for us is Geeta Gutierrez.
During his interrogations, and I should also qualify that these descriptions are from U.S. government documents. They're from FOIA, Freedom of Information Act government documents. They're from statements made by interrogators. This is what I'm going to tell you is not just based on allegations from Mohammed, and that's something that's unique about his case. An interrogation log was leaked from Guantanamo that described nearly 50 days of sleep deprivation that Mohammed was subjected to. He was given 20-hour interrogations and only permitted to sleep early in the morning or the middle of the day to disrupt his his mindset and his mental capabilities. He was sexually humiliated by female interrogators when male MPs held him down on the ground, pinned him to the floor, and allowed a female interrogator to straddle him and molest him. He was subjected to forced nudity. He had an enema given to him by medical professionals at Guantanamo during interrogations in front of military police and interrogators. In addition to religious humiliation, having his beard and head shaved, and all other kinds of stress positions and physical abuse that accompanied this. Prior to that interrogation log, the 3 months going into it, or prior to it, he was held in such severe isolation that an FBI deputy director who observed him actually reported up to an official in the Army a concern about prisoner mistreatment because he observed Mr. Al-Qahtani exhibiting clear signs of psychological trauma. So that's a little bit of what we know from government documents. The interrogation log ends in January 2003. We pick up again in April 2003 when Secretary Rumsfeld actually authorized a fake rendition of Mohammed, where he was drugged and hooded and goggled and placed on a plane at Guantanamo, flown around, brought back to Guantanamo and told he was in a foreign country, one that would subject him to torture. And he was held in a different part of the prison facility and denied, the Red Cross was denied access to him for several months. And these are the kinds of extraordinarily outrageous and lawless things that have happened to him. And again, that's really only very little of what occurred to him. These are the things that we can point to that are corroborated by government documents. Our visits are also extremely restrictive. We are meeting in the same type of cell and perhaps at times the same cell where he was held during his interrogations.
That was Gita Gutierrez talking about her client and the Center for Constitutional Rights client, Mohammed Al-Qahtani. The techniques the U.S. is doing to torture people are not new. These practices go back many, many years. They've been studied by the United States. They've used these in other places. And one, of course, the classic techniques, which goes back to the 16th century in Inquisition France, is called waterboarding. That's where you just strap a person to a board. You start filling their mouths up with water until they're almost drowned. They think they're drowned. You revive them, and then you eventually do it again and again until they confess to something, usually whatever you want them to say. In an exclusive interview Law and Disorder did a number of months ago with Henri Alleg, we brought you a firsthand description of waterboarding. Henri Alleg was a newspaper editor in Algeria during the French-Algerian War. The French didn't like what he was saying in his newspaper. They picked him up and they tortured him. And how did they torture him? With waterboarding. So now we'll hear Henri Alleg's description of his torture at the hands of the French, waterboarding.
It's bringing someone to the brink of death, and it's not only a great sufferance as if you were drowning, but also a sort of terrible agony, terrible feeling of dying. You're dying. You know you're dying. Tell you that if you move your fingers, it will seize, and if you don't, you're going to die. So it's a strong torture, and perhaps even more terrible, because you have to fight against the anxiety of not being able to bear two or three times that feeling of death.
Now, Henri, I remember when I read the book, you said the first time you didn't realize it was going to happen, and you didn't something with your fingers so that your fingers moved involuntarily.
Yes.
And then the next time you took some action so that didn't happen. Can you just describe that?
Yes. Well, I prefer death than a new trial of that feeling of going again and again near the brink of dying. A terrible thing to hear that some responsible people can say that such an experience is not torture.
Mm-hmm. That was Henri Alleg, and I want you to remember what you heard there is what recently Vice President Cheney said he would not oppose, or he was asked, do you think there's anything wrong with giving someone a little dunk in the water? By that meaning waterboarding. Cheney said, of course not, if it can save lives. We've given you a lot of the descriptions of who's at Guantanamo, what's happening to them, how the U.S. got the base. And I also want to give you a sense of the legal fight that the Center for Constitutional Rights and now some 500 lawyers have been engaging in to try and get Guantanamo closed down and to get people the legal rights that they're entitled to under international law and the Constitution. It's been a very difficult fight. We're still engaged in the midst of it. Partly as a result of the fight, partly as a result of growing opposition from countries all over the world, from prime ministers, from United Nations people, from masses of people saying Guantanamo was an outrage, shut it down, we've actually been able to free about 400 of the 800 or so people who've passed through Guantanamo. But there are still 400 people there. The U.S. still plans on building a prison and a courtroom, in fact, a new courtroom for $125 million to supposedly try some people. We'll see if that ever happens. But in any case, we've been engaged in this bitter, bitter legal fight with the U.S. government for 5 years. For the first 2 years, we filed our cases on behalf of our clients. We tried to get them the writ of habeas corpus. Finally, in June 2004, remember that date, we won in the Supreme Court. Incredible. The Supreme Court said every human being, everybody at Guantanamo, has a right to go into a court and say to the government, give me a legal reason for why you're holding me. At that point, what happens? We start litigating. We get all these lawyers again to try and get people their rights to hearings in federal courts. And then the Republican Congress, sadly joined by a number of Democrats, passed what's called the Detainee Treatment Act. That act was passed in 2005. It purportedly took away the right of habeas corpus from the people at Guantanamo. We went to court again. And what happens in 2006, just a few months ago, June 2006, the Supreme Court again said Guantanamo detainees have the right to get writs of habeas corpus filed and there should be hearings in federal court. So there we are again thinking we'll get our hearings. And let me just say something. Once those hearings happen, I can guarantee our listeners there will be nobody left in Guantanamo because the government can't prove anything against the people at Guantanamo. What evidence they have is from torture and hearsay. So it will clean out that camp. That's why the government's resisting it. So we go and we win, as I said, in June 2006 in the Supreme Court again. Again, the Bush administration goes back to the Congress. And what does Congress do for the second time? This time it does it in what it calls a, quote, better way, in a way that it think it'll get past the Supreme Court. Again, strips habeas corpus from the detainees at Guantanamo, and just for good measure, strips it from any non-citizen who the U.S. holds as an enemy combatant anywhere in the world. That means in the United States. That means anywhere. And once again, where are we now? We are again litigating in the courts, in the Court of Appeals. Again, we're going to go to the Supreme Court. And of course, it's a sad story. It's a story of great struggle. It's a story in which we've gotten a lot of people freed, not really as the direct result of the court case. But the sad part here is Congress has gone along with this outrage of taking away habeas, and now we're going to have to fight it in the Supreme Court again. Clients will have been there for almost 7 years by the time we again are able to try and get a writ of habeas corpus, a hearing for people at Guantanamo. It's a legal, political, and moral outrage. In the 5 years that Guantanamo has existed as an interrogation torture camp, there's been growing opposition all over the world, first beginning in Europe, spreading to some of the Arabic countries, and then around the world, and even home in the United States. There has been protests, demonstrations, and many objections to Guantanamo. We're now going to listen to a segment from a demonstration about a year and a half ago, at Herald Square in New York, which was the first really major public demonstration in the United States against Guantanamo, Cuba.
I think it's disgusting that the United States has now come to the point where kidnapping people and imprisoning them without any fair legal process, and a lot of the prisoners in Guantanamo were sold to the U.S. forces because they were giving out basically bribes to bring people in.
And Guantanamo is a symbol of the foreign policy that is alienating the rest of the world and trashing our civil rights.
I agree with him. I don't think it's good to be having naked people just being abused and doing that kind of thing.
I don't really think that's why they're using it. I think they know full well that they can't get accurate information from people using that. I don't think they're dummies.
They're going to do this to everybody. This will become standard practice, and even citizens won't have protection.
It's really frightening. It's really frightening. I think they're using it to strike terror into people's hearts, and that we should all be afraid, because I think they full well intend to use it on us.
We go now to hear the voices of demonstrators and protesters at the Amnesty International anti-torture meeting and rally in Portland, Oregon.
So we have to decide whether we will let fear govern us or whether we want moral people governing us.
Immediately after I learned about Amnesty, I knew that human rights were something that was really important to me, and I wanted to get into it as much as possible. So I, after going to the meeting in Boston, the regional meeting, I realized I was going to do everything possible to get to the national meeting because I want to have a say in this.
I'm wearing handcuffs to show my solidarity with the prisoners and everyone who's dealing with this injustice that's going on. And then on my arms I have written dignity for all, real big and black. Because it's not justice for all, it's dignity for all. I mean, exactly. If it's not something we would do to our own people, we cannot justify it for other people. We cannot.
Sorry.
All right.
I think a lot of people wonder sort of how did we get here? How did we get to the point where we're trying to talk about how do we get the U.S. government to stop justifying torture? I would assert that this is an administration who forgot the rule of law. They created a category of enemy combatants, which is supposed to be a group of people that are so bad that they don't actually have any rights that exist in the law, just the rules that the U.S. government decides to apply to them at any given time.
Voices from the Amnesty International rally in Portland, Oregon. Now we're engaged in massive protests leading up and on January 11th to the fifth anniversary of Guantanamo Bay. There's going to be a major demonstration and speak out and press conference in Washington, D.C. It will begin on the steps of the Supreme Court, where you'll hear the Center for Constitutional Rights, Amnesty International, and Witness Against Torture all speak out against Guantanamo Bay. There will be direct action in Washington, D.C. There'll be mass protest. That will only be part of what's going on all over the country, in cities in the United States, and in cities throughout the world where there will be protests against this human rights abomination known as Guantanamo Bay. Go to the website of the Center for Constitutional Rights, ccr-ny.org. It will also be on the website of Amnesty International, ai.org. Go to those websites, get involved. This is a chance to show the world that we in the United States will not stand for an American gulag at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
My mind keeps on telling me that this is no good. My heart is aching and tells me I should, and only time will show the wiser. For I've fallen in love with a girl that's not mine. If I take her, it will hurt him, the very best friend of mine. But I know I need someone to hold, to love. But my mind says I shouldn't, and my heart says I should. And I don't know which to go by, my mind or my heart. This is so confusing, it's tearing me apart. Time, it will show the wiser. And I wish someone could help me, but the decision is mine. And my morals and emotions are hard to combine. And there is no easy way out, so I'll let it just ride to the day that he finds out of the love I hide. 'Cause I don't know which to go by, my mind or my heart. This is so confusing, it's tearing me apart. Time, it will show. Time, it will show the wiser.